Hello and welcome to episode 29 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal, which we've snappily called. So that was the end of part 2 of phase 3 of the Post Office Horizon IT inquiry. We are recording this episode on the evening of Monday 13th, March 2023. My name is Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Horizon IT scandal for Computer Weekly back in 2009.
Hello, I am Rebecca's co-host. My name is Nick Wallace. I am the author of the book, The Great Post Office Scandal.
It has been a pretty significant 3 weeks at the inquiry, and we've seen several key themes emerge as Phase 3 progresses. For anyone needing a reminder, Phase 3 focuses on the early operation of the Horizon system, training for sub-postmasters, and modifications of the system.
The Post Office Horizon scandal, if you are wondering about that, is the most widespread miscarriage of justice in UK legal history. In 1999-2000, the Post Office rolled out a piece of accounting and retail software called Horizon into every Post Office branch in the country, and it made its sub-postmasters legally responsible for the accounting figures that it produced. Unfortunately, Horizon didn't work very well and rendered faulty accounts. The Post Office forced thousands of sub-postmasters to pay for these accounting errors out of their own pockets, and they falsely prosecuted several hundred more for theft and false accounting.
The public inquiry into the scandal began in 2022. So phase one was the human impact sessions, which started in February last year. Phase two looked into the commissioning, development and rollout of the system, and phase three began in January this year, stopped for 3 weeks and then started again in February, finishing last week with the evidence of Fujitsu whistleblower Richard Roll.
So joining us to have a chat about some of the evidence that we've heard over the past 3 weeks is Varchas Patel, son of Vipin Patel, who was among the first cohort of sub-postmasters to have his conviction quashed back in December 2020. Welcome to you, Varchas.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the podcast, both you and Rebecca.
Hey, man, it's an absolute pleasure. And thank you for doing this at very short notice. It's great to have you on board.
Thank you.
Rebecca and I have got to know Varchas through our reporting of this scandal, and Varchas and I are both trustees of the Horizon Scandal Fund, which is a charity set up by my publishers, Bath Publishing, to help sub-postmasters and their families. But anyway, welcome aboard. It's great to have you on the podcast. How much of the recent sort of three-week chunk of evidence have you had a chance to look at?
Oh, God. If I put a percentage on that, I'd say about 30 to 40%.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah.
I tried to keep up with it because from what I've gathered so far, as time progresses, more and more damning evidence does come out. The more I watch it, the more I go through it, the more I realise there were some very, very serious issues within the Post Office, which clearly falsely branded all these innocent sub-postmasters as thieves. I mean, it's a bit difficult when you're trying to juggle a daytime job, so I try to keep up with it sometimes in my lunch breaks or sometimes after work, but I'm constantly speaking to mum and dad is literally glued to his iPad, always watching.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, really?
We must talk about your dad's position as well, because I know he's been fighting for compensation and you've been helping him fight for compensation since his conviction was quashed. But we'll get to that after we've got to the evidence of the last 3 weeks. And I think one person who we all saw give evidence was Amandeep Singh. So let's deal with him first.
Yes, he gave evidence on Tuesday last week. So he worked as a first-line Horizon help desk support operator back in 2000 as an undergraduate. So when the IT system was very new, he was initially assigned to provide support to Epson printers, but then his whole team was switched to the Horizon system and they had to deal with sub-postmasters who were also trying to figure things out as they went along. Amandeep only gave evidence for around 35 minutes, but it was powerful stuff.
A lot of postmasters had worked in their branches for decades in some cases, and they'd never been around even a personal computer. And some of them wouldn't, you'd have to explain to them what the mouse was in some cases. I mean, they wouldn't know what you meant by a mouse. I mean, this is the age of the time that we were dealing with certain people. Not everybody, but a lot of postmasters were elderly. Some of them, I mean, a lot of them weren't IT literate at all.
What training, if any, did you receive in how to deal with people of different computer literacies?
Nothing.
A paragraph 6 of your statement, you say that the floor was quite a toxic place. Could you tell us a bit about what you mean by that?
It was toxic because the the other members of the staff that were, if you like, the second line team, the whole second line team had been sort of abandoned and everybody had just merged into this Horizon help desk. So there was there's a hierarchy of the second line teams who we would never interact with as first line engineers on the Epson team, because we really, some of them, we would hate having to put calls through to them because they would almost belittle you in some way when you would pass a call to them, like, can you not deal with this yourself? There was that dynamic where you didn't really associate with those guys. And then when they were all brought in and everybody was equalized and on the same level, that caused a great deal of animosity. And then layer on top of that, you're now not supporting maybe graphic design agencies or media companies as second line engineers were doing. And now you're supporting, you know, an old lady in Wales that doesn't know what even a personal computer is. I think a lot of them felt like the role was beneath them. And that animosity, that toxicity, it just grew and grew. And, you know, I think at the time, there was always stories in the newspapers of somebody maybe, you know, frauding or defrauding or doing something. And if somebody rings you up and says, you know, £50,000 or £10,000 is missing, and you'd be like, even, you know, you'd question it, how can you miscalculate £10,000 or £2,000? It's not, you know, a couple of stamps here or there, and you can't reconcile to £20 or £30. But these were huge figures that people were quoting. But once somebody said, oh, I've got another Patel, and then you could just never get away from that whole Patel thing. And it would be like, who could come up with the most outlandish story? Oh, I've got a Patel, I've got another Patel. You just hear it constantly on the floor. And being obviously of an Asian background, there was me and there was another gentleman called Zubair. We were the only two ethnic minorities on the support desk at all, on the whole entire floor. And that was it, with the only people of sort of colour on that floor. And at no point was anybody reeling it back and saying, well, what is this, you know, the language that was being used. And my grievance with it was that, why don't we just focus on the individual or the actual, this cultural dynamic, this mistrust that was just feeding through. It felt like some individuals could never get beyond that, could never look beyond that and try and do the role that they were instructed to do.
That was Amandeep Singh at the Post Office Horizon IT Inquiry with barrister Ruth Kennedy asking the questions. How did you react when you first heard that, Varchas?
I was shocked. I was very, very shocked. And it took me about a couple of days to even gather my thoughts. My family instantly thought it is a total annihilation of the wider Patel community.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Your surname is Patel. So the Patel thing, obviously, in the way that Amandeep was talking about it, his colleagues were using it as a generic term of, well, essentially racist abuse against Asians. But you being a Patel as well, you took it very personally.
I found that hurtful because, you know, being the son of my mother and father, my mother and father came to this country with literally nothing. Nothing, no inheritance, no nothing. And they worked for everything, from staying in their first council house to buying their first property and then subsequently buying their shop.
Do I remember you telling me that your family was kicked out of Uganda by Idi Amin when he expelled all the Asians from Uganda?
Yes, yeah, so mother was in India at the time, but father and his family were in Uganda and they had set up various businesses. Subsequently, all the Asians, in the eyes of Idi Amin, were quite prosperous. And for some bizarre reason, he issued a 90-day warning. If you did not leave the country in 90 days, you would be murdered, killed, hurt, everything.
Mm. And basically just stole all your assets.
Basically.
Hence the reason your father arrived with nothing.
Yes, he came with 50p in his pocket. So when I heard another scamming Patel the other day or last week, I found that quite offensive because my father has worked hard for everything he has gained, achieved.
Did he ever say with his interactions with the post office, did he ever get a sense of this attitude? Did it come out across in other parts of his interactions?
Okay, and that's quite interesting. So when Father was the manager of Acton Crown Post Office, when we were living in London, he wanted to progress. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there was a position at one of the remittance centres, which was quite a highly regarded position. He applied for that job, but in recent months and years, when I've asked Father why he wasn't able to progress within the post office hierarchy, he did say it sort of felt like there was a glass roof ceiling there, and they already had people they wanted to place in those positions, whereas in the likes of Mr. Patel were just not able to progress any further.
Well, I mean, one of the things that struck me about my last sort of 10 years working on this story is the ethnic mix of sub-postmasters is very broad. Yet, yes, when you are dealing with post office staff, they are regulation Susans, Andys, Peters, Mikes, Pauls, Daves. You know, you don't come across very many people of a non-white extraction over the period of time that I've been looking at this scandal, working for the post office directly. And you do wonder how that has come about, given what Amandeep was saying about this cultural misunderstanding of the people that they were dealing with, that they just became dismissive of them in an openly racist way. Mm. But his point was, it didn't allow them to see the individual and the individual struggle that they were having trying to reconcile with this stupid IT system.
Yes. I mean, when Father was at Acton Crown Post Office, he managed the branch flawlessly. And when he resigned from being manager and purchased his sub-post office, there were issues more or less straight away. And he's always maintained that he tried using Helpline on a number of occasions, but he found them useless. So during the later years of his tenure as sub-postmaster, he started reporting problems to Chesterfield, which were in his view a little bit better than Helpline, but the same issues arose.
Was there anything else that jumped out at you in Amandeep's evidence voucher? So I thought what he was saying about management was really interesting, the sort of complete lack of action.
Yes, that's basically it. It struck me very hard that these things, for example, another scamming Patel, were being said and shouted across the room, and yet managers were present or walking around, and that they did not stop this type of toxic culture. And it struck me that this sort of toxic culture grew and nothing was done about it.
This is what he says in his witness statement. The floor on those days was toxic, unchallenged by managers who looked away as all Asians were called Patels regardless of surname. Shouts across the floor could be heard saying, "I have another Patel scamming again." They mistrusted every Asian postmaster, which really is a damning indictment of what was going on.
I mean, in my view, it is a lack of good governance.
I think one thing that we ought to do before we move on is just to point out that although we've been talking about potentially toxic culture within the post office and attitudes towards sub-postmasters, Amandeep did work for Fujitsu on the Horizon Helpline support, and it was there that he that came across the phrases like scamming Patels, etc. I think it's just important just to make that distinction. Okay, let's have a listen to the witness who came the day after Amandeep Singh. Andy Dunks was his name. Now, Andy Dunks has been employed by Fujitsu for more than 20 years, and he achieved a degree of infamy when he was found to have attempted to mislead Mr. Justice Fraser during the Bates v. Post Office litigation at the High Court back in 2019. And that was when he told the judge that there was no party line when it came to Fujitsu supplying witness statements for the prosecution of sub-postmasters, which turned out to be untrue. Dunks was back on oath last Wednesday and very keen to tell the inquiry that there was a party line or standard template when it came to the witness statements, and he was the person supplying them. So let's have a listen to some of his evidence. And this time it's Jason Beer asking the questions.
Where did you get the understanding from that your duty was limited to the supply of existing records rather than the analysis of them?
From our training that we had and from our management team.
Who gave you the training? When was that given?
For audit retrieval, it would have been the person who was running it at the time I joined the team.
So the lady whose name you can't remember gave you some on-the-job training?
Yeah.
And you said your managers, can you remember any conversations or discussions with them as to whether your job was just to supply the records of help desk calls or whether you needed to conduct an analysis of them, i.e. to set out what they showed, in your view?
That wasn't a request. That was never a request unless it was a specific request from the post office security team.
And how would the post office security team make such a specific request?
On the ARQ form.
And so when the post office security team made a specific request to analyse, that was identified on the form?
No. Again, the form would have said, can you please supply, I don't know the exact wording, but it was basically supply a list of all the help desk calls in that date range.
And so did you never understand that it was your role to analyse the data that you were supplying?
It wasn't a specific role, but that's something I undertook later on.
Why did you undertake it later on?
Because we had a request for a statement for analysis of those calls.
So it was only when you were asked to provide a witness statement did you analyse the data that you were providing?
Correct.
So does it follow that, save where there was actually a prosecution or civil proceedings afoot, i.e. it had got to that stage, the post office never asked you to analyse the data that you were providing to set out what it showed?
Yes.
What kind of litigation did you think the witness statements were being used for?
For, I think I said earlier, it was for prosecutions.
Did you know about civil proceedings?
No. I wouldn't know what the difference was.
Andy Dunks, the man tasked with analysing or supplying data to the post office prosecution team, who doesn't or didn't at the time know the difference between civil and criminal proceedings, which is quite worrying. Now, Rebecca, you've done your homework and cooked up a triple whammy of post office witnesses from the last 3 weeks of the inquiry. Anne Alica, Gail Peacock, and the extraordinary Susan Harding. I'm giggling because when Susan Harding was giving evidence, there was a lot of reaction on social media. They all had interesting things to say for different reasons. So do you want to take over this section of the podcast and guide us through them? And so we can have a listen to some of the clips that you've picked out as well.
Yeah, Anne Alica is a former contract advisor and a former auditor. And she discussed the fact that for her, the idea that for her and probably for her team as well, the idea that Horizon could cause a loss when they were going about their work, their business, just wasn't even considered. She said that teams across the business received constant reassurances about the IT, but she also then couldn't actually say where those reassurances came from. I thought that she showed how post office teams, probably across the entire business, almost by osmosis, accepted that Horizon was infallible without that clear understanding of exactly how they came to know that, who said it. So here, counsel to the inquiry, Sam Stevens, is asking her what her response would have been if a postmaster had come to her and told her that Horizon had caused discrepancies in their accounts.
If, as a contract advisor, someone had said that to you directly, mm-hmm. what would your response have been?
I probably would have done my best to, try and make them understand that it wasn't possible, that, you know, that whatever had gone wrong, we'd investigate it, and there was no way that it could be the Horizon system because of all the assurances that we got.
When you say all the assurances you got, could you just expand on that, please?
Well, we've always been of the impression that anything that did go wrong with Horizon, that somewhere in the background it was put right. If it had got to the point where a branch had a loss, they would receive a transaction correction for it, or if a branch had a loss that they couldn't explain, there was an option to put it into the suspense account sometimes to see if a transaction correction came back later down the line. But any investigation had never, or any, you know, looking into losses had never thrown up anything to do with the Horizon system having caused the loss. So I presume that, you know, we just all trusted what we were told, and that a loss couldn't be caused by the system itself.
Who gave you those assurances?
I don't know whether it was just generally everybody said the same thing. I don't know that we necessarily even looked to anybody for assurance. It was just that if that came up ever, that's what we knew, that it must have been mentioned at some point, but I cannot honestly point to one person and say they did.
That was Anne Alica being questioned by Sam Stevens. The next witness that I wanted to have a really quick look at was Gail Peacock, who is a former Network Efficiency Programme Manager, who was shown, as part of her evidence, she was shown in an internal report that she had written, stating, among other things, that Second Sight's review, which, as we know, was critical of Horizon, had found no issues with the IT. So obviously this was untrue, and it was based, she said, on information given to her by her boss, Angela van den Bogaert. She didn't ask at the time to see the Second Sight report, which she acknowledged that she should have. Instead, she said that she trusted her manager. Here, she's being asked about information that may have been kept from her.
We've looked at, for example, the Second Sight report that wasn't shared with you. Was there, in respects of bugs, errors and defects, information that was kept from you, do you think, intentionally?
I don't know, and I've reflected on this, obviously, since you've sent the information. And, you know, when you ask the question, like, in the witness statement, well, why were you selected to do the branch support programme? The positive side of me goes, because I thought I had the right skills to do the job. Having seen some of this stuff, the cynical part of me goes, well, was I picked because I would do what I was told? I don't know. I trusted the people that I worked for. Accepted the information that was in good faith. I don't know what they kept from me. I wouldn't like to think that they were deliberately doing that, but I couldn't, unless you ask them, I don't know.
That was Gail Peacock being questioned by Julian Blake. So I found her really interesting because her evidence kind of raised questions for me. Were people being picked for key roles because they could be trusted not to question things? Was this a conscious strategy? I mean, maybe not, but it's really interesting to see someone suggesting that it was a possibility. I also thought that Gail Peacock was being quite reflective there, which not all witnesses at the inquiry are. Varchas, did you have any immediate responses to Gail's evidence?
Well, I've never, ever come across an employee that has thrown her manager under the bus.
No.
I feel like we're going to start to see...
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of this over the next
I think it's
going to
be a running theme, and the managers will throw their teams under the bus in response.
If they can, yeah. I mean, Angela van den Bogaert, being her boss, is also someone who has been found to mislead Mr. Justice Fraser at the High Court. So she doesn't really have a reputation to defend, although I do take your point, Varchas. I mean, one thing that I find extraordinary is that if she has written an internal report stating that Second Sight's review had found no issues with Horizon without reading the original, I think, 13-page report I think it's actually even less than that. I think it was 13 pages with appendices, with case studies tacked on the end. It is honestly, it's something like 6 or 7 pages, the main body of that second site report. If she couldn't even be bothered to read that for herself before...
Yeah, but it kind of brings up such an interesting point that goes back to Amandeep Singh's evidence, which is that question of trust. These people just had this implicit trust, whether it was in their managers, whether it was in the technical staff. You've heard it so many times, people just saying, oh, I trusted them. I trusted what they were telling me. I'd worked with them for years. And so they didn't check what they were being told. They didn't read the report. They didn't ask questions. But if you were on the wrong side of this random equation and you were kind of culturally mistrusted, then there was almost no way to ever get to be in a position of being trusted, if that makes sense. It was so sort of hard in people's minds, like who was trusted and who wasn't.
I think that's a good point. And I'm trying to think, if my boss had told me something as a fact, would I then go and put it in a report with my name on it without checking the source? I suppose it depends how much I trust my boss not to be an idiot, but
yeah,
if my boss was absolutely authoritative.
Yeah, and I think it depends on your background, and it depends on so many things.
I suppose it's legitimate, isn't it? If your boss tells you something in writing is a fact.
Yeah,
want to see the source document.
You probably would, but then that sort of speaks to what you've done for in your career.
Maybe 20 years ago I wouldn't have done. Maybe 20 years ago, as a sort of young journalist, I would have gone, okay, boss, okay, that sounds.
If you say this, then why would I question you?
As you get older and uglier, you get less inclined to trust.
Yeah, don't trust anyone.
I think it also depends on how your boss says it. So, for instance, for me, if my boss asked me nicely, and I liked my boss, I trusted my boss, well, you perhaps may go with the flow. But on the other occasion, if your boss speaks to you assertively and you can kind of gauge that there could be some suspicious activity over here, I will definitely be reluctant to just do whatever my boss asks me to do.
Yeah, for sure. And there's definitely plenty of evidence in lots of the witnesses that we've heard from, with people just not picking up on the red flags. They're just sort of institutionally blinded, I guess, that they don't sort of have suspicion where they should.
Right, that brings us to Susan Harding.
Oh God.
Yes. So, sorry. Oh, that really got me. So Susan Harding was involved in the process of getting rid of the suspense account. So the suspense account was, I don't even know how to describe it exactly, but it was a sort of account where postmasters could put their discrepancies in order to allow them to continue trading. So if you were down £10,000, you could put that £10,000 in the suspense account and it could allow you to keep trading without having to immediately cough up the 10 grand discrepancy. Her evidence was damning for the post office in a few different ways, but particularly for me in showing an ingrained belief in postmasters' dishonesty. So we're back with trust. She absolutely did not trust the postmasters, and here she is talking about that.
Many, many, many postmasters prior to Horizon had been prosecuted for either falsely accounting, basically, either saying the cash and stock was there for hiding it in suspense. And I could tell you lots of cases that of somebody where the auditors, because the auditors only used to audit sub post offices maybe once every 3 years. And I can remember there was one, I think it was Harrow in the Hill, was quite infamous, where the auditors turned up at the door because that's what they did. And he said, I want to fetch the keys out of my car. And then he went. So that was it. And the finance director, I ran this on behalf of my sponsor, the finance director, but it was clear that, and I'm not disrespecting any of the people that had been jailed if Horizon was wrong, but there had been many people...
So you said if Horizon was wrong?
I'm not doubting it was wrong.
Can we remove if from that sentence?
Yes. Okay. So... But people had been jailed for many, many years for false accounting because that's what they got jailed for.
So is it fair to say that this mindset, might I call it, that you operated under
was that suspense was all about crime. It's about cover-ups by dishonest postmasters hiding discrepancies. And that mindset continued in your 40 years in the post office.
Well, I wasn't 40 years in the post office. I was in Royal Mail and things before that. So, but once I was involved in that, it wasn't me. I was, you know, I had a sponsor for this who was the finance director, and we were trying to achieve something that meant that accounts were accurate and that the cash and stock that was in the office, or the accounts were accurate, and the cash and stock that was in the offices was in the offices.
And would you mind kindly answering my question?
Could you repeat the question?
Yes. Did you have a mindset in the entirety of your time working for post office that the suspense account was used by dishonest sub-postmasters to hide and cover up money that they were taking?
My mindset was that it was a place where they could do that.
And did do that?
Yes, I did do that.
And that it wasn't used for any other purpose?
Well, it might have been used for any other purpose. It might have been used for other purposes as well, but there were other ways those things could have been dealt with.
Did you think it was used for any other purpose, like an innocent purpose?
I don't know. It could have been.
Well, did you? Can you help?
I can't remember. All. I think it could be used. I'll rephrase it then. It could be used for any purpose, but why would you if your account balance? So it must have been to do with something that either they knew was causing their account to misbalance, or because their account misbalanced and they needed somewhere to put the difference.
It didn't have to be
fraudulent.
That was Susan Harding being questioned by Jason Beer. So I thought she was really interesting because of that deeply held belief that she exhibited that postmasters were most likely to be using the suspense account dishonestly, a belief that she seems even today to struggle to leave behind. What did you think of her evidence, Varchas? Did you pick up on the same things or something else?
Where do I start? First and foremost, it was a big question mark for me for the fact that she took away the suspense account and why. From her point of view, she thought by leaving these suspense accounts active or there, well, there would be dishonest sub-postmasters or mistresses who have been using these suspense accounts for a very long time. So it was, in my mind, witnessing her giving evidence, genuinely do not believe she trusted sub-postmasters, even when they called for help for example discrepancies and so forth.
What did you think of the way she gave evidence?
It was what's the word? I thought she was a little bit abrupt.
You're being very polite. I thought she's the sort of person that you'd describe with the phrase piece of work. She came across like a real piece of work.
Well, I mean, there was one fact that I did pick up on. She was more or less in headquarters or head office in her post office career. But the fact that she was managing this huge change of removing the suspense accounts, had she had a job working in a branch office or a sub post office, she would have realized firsthand by removing the suspense account, you are actually leaving the sub-postmaster or sub-postmistress with a huge problem.
Actually, you just reminded me of an interview that I did with Patrick Green, who was the lead barrister for the sub-postmasters in the group litigation. But I said to him, what one thing would you say that the post office could have done to change the outcome of this scandal? And he said I would have kept the suspense button on the Horizon terminal, because that would have meant that postmasters weren't being forced to be liable for their accounts and then wouldn't get debt recovery notices issued to them for these discrepancies once they were forced to press settle centrally or settle to cash rather than having the option to put it all into suspense. So that was Patrick Green's take as to where this all went horribly wrong. And I know postmasters were getting prosecuted before the suspense button was removed, but he said He said that was the thing, removing the suspense button. Basically, you created a massive trap, which postmasters were just herded into.
It must have massively increased the numbers of people getting prosecuted and people losing
all their
money.
Or just the misery. I mean, you know, at least if something's in suspense, you haven't taken liability for it and you're still able to trade. Now you're being told you either accept liability or you stop trading.
You see, the thing is, in my view, if the suspense account was still there, and if it was well managed, if within the post office there was a proper investigative team, right, you could really investigate every single discrepancy within the suspense account. But once you've taken that suspense account out, once you've removed that functionality, literally it's either a case of, well, you either accept the shortfall and you add more monies in, or your personal monies into the post office, or next morning you've got a huge problem.
I do remember Ron Warmington telling me that when he worked for large institutions and banks, they had suspense accounts. And I think Ron told me that he was in charge of signing off any removal of money from the suspense accounts, because he would demand that every single penny in there was accounted for properly and agreed by all parties as to where it had come from and to whom it was owed before it could be taken out of it. And there was just no function like that within the post office. It went into a suspense account and seemed to go into a vortex, a void, which the post office just didn't know how to unravel. And so that was their incentive for getting rid of it, because they were just getting too much money being parked in suspense, or too many discrepancies being parked in suspense, and they just didn't know how to work out who was owed what.
So their
solution was just go, oh, let's just get rid of it and put it all on the sub-postmasters.
With that underlying belief that it was because it was all being done dishonestly.
What they should have done, in my view, is, well, I've said this, but I'll say it again. Keep the suspense account there. But then you would allow the sub-postmaster and or the investigative team, for example, 48 to 72 hours, looking at that data snapshot. That very data snapshot taken on Wednesday. So, you know, by doing that, you wouldn't be putting pressure on the sub-postmaster or the sub-postmistress to accept liability or not.
And this is not water under the bridge, is it? Because your father was a victim of this. He's had his conviction quashed. And I think last time we spoke, the solicitors who are working with your father are still trying to get some kind of agreement as to what level of compensation he should be given. Have you got? I appreciate that you may not want to talk too much about this, because if the negotiations are going on at the moment, but the headline is that your father still hasn't accepted the offer that's been made because he considers it nowhere near enough. Is that right?
Okay, so basically, first and foremost, father and post office, they are in mediation, so I cannot talk about it.
Oh, okay. No, fair
enough. I cannot discuss what is inside mediation, but I genuinely believe my father would have achieved great success had he not been prosecuted. Because once you put a criminal conviction like fraud or false accounting on a person, it's very, very, very difficult, if not near enough impossible, for example, a bank to lend to you. You've got this conviction, no one trusts you anymore. You've been convicted for fraud or false accounting or theft, and it really is a huge blow.
I see what you're saying, because of course it happened so long ago. If your father's career had carried on in the same trajectory, who knows what he'd be doing now. He could have a property empire or a business empire, because he was obviously an industrious and entrepreneurial man. Like you say, a criminal conviction is just going to put a massive spanner in any of that, no matter how much you try and get around it. Well, do pass on our regards to your father and your mother as well, Varchas, and thank you very much for coming on this podcast to talk about what's been happening over the last 3 weeks. Before we go, can I just have a chat with you about the Horizon Scandal Fund? Because despite the fact that you and your family are going through pain, still waiting 3 years after a conviction being quashed to get your compensation, you very kindly agreed to come on board as a trustee of the Horizon Scandal Fund, which is all about helping other sub-postmasters and their families.
Indeed.
When did we become a charity? When did we actually get
I think it was about 2 years ago.
No. When we became a registered charity. So we set up as a fund in November 21, but I think it took another year before we were a registered charity. So it hasn't been that long since we've been a registered charity, but the donations have been coming in and we've been helping people ever since. And I just wondered if you could explain to people who may not have come across the charity and what it does a little bit about the way we operate and what we're set up to do.
Okay, sure. So the Horizon Scandal Fund is a charity where we help affected sub postmasters. So, for example, we help with hardship grants. That could be, for example, rent, your gas or electricity bill. We also help in other areas. For example, if you needed counselling or therapy. If one needed legal fees, we do help out the affected sub-postmaster as much as we can. Obviously, there is a formal process to follow, as you know, by being a charity.
Yeah, we've both been learning a lot about the administration of a charity and being a trustee.
It takes a very long time. Yeah.
Good governance. We're learning a lot about good governance. But
yes,
I mean, one of the things that we set the charity up to do is to provide, as you say, all those things that you've listed, but in a way that didn't require the endless filling out of forms, so long as we'd done the right due diligence on speaking to the people involved and seeing that their need was genuine. Because, you know, we found that so many sub-postmasters have just been beaten down by the endless form filling to get anywhere or to get any kind of compensation. So it was set up in the knowledge that there would always be people who would be in need as a result of this scandal, or who would fall through the gaps when it came through compensation. And it's been, I mean, I don't know about you, but I didn't expect this, but it's been quite rewarding to be able to help people in those myriad ways, even with things just like paying for someone to go on a short weekend away break, you know, yes, for their first holiday in 19 years, which they wouldn't otherwise have the funds to do. And we've been also, I think, quite overwhelmed by the generosity of people who've contributed to the fund over the past year and a half. I mean, it really has been staggering how generous and wonderful people have been. I suppose now we're sort of established as a proper charity and as proper trustees, and we've got a mechanism for receiving money and handing it out. We just need to expand our operations, Varchess.
Definitely.
But we should also say that if there's anyone listening to this who knows a sub-postmaster or a family member who's been affected by this scandal, or you've been directly affected by it yourself, then it really is quite simple to apply for a grant for pretty much anything that, you know, is something that you need. I mean, we've looked at things, haven't we, like medical equipment, we've looked at respite care, as you say, all those things like paying for legal fees, paying for counselling. We were even able to fund a get-together for a group of sub-postmasters just to have dinner and talk to each other about their situations, because, of course, so many sub-postmasters are isolated geographically, and getting together to have that sort of, I suppose it's almost group therapy, isn't it, talking to people who've been in a similar situation, costs money. And so just even being able to hand out little grants for things like that has been, yeah, it's been
even
quite
the
rewarding.
Travel costs, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much, Varchess, for joining us. It's been brilliant
thanks,
to have
Varchess.
You.
No, the inquiry. No, thank you both for having me.
Our pleasure. You can come.
It has been so insightful. The inquiry returns on the 27th of April for another compensation hearing, and then shortly after that we will restart with two former Fujitsu engineers, Anne Chambers and Gareth Jenkins, who will be cross-examined over 4 days. Both Chambers and Jenkins have previously given evidence in court stating that the Horizon system was robust, and both have been questioned by the Metropolitan Police in relation to that, so their evidence could potentially be very interesting.
We always use the word interesting because it's a nice neutral word. But in this case, I think it could be very interesting. So this actually might be our last Investigating the Post Office Scandal podcast for a while, as I'm going to be rather busy with other projects over the next few weeks. I've got a book which is not about the post office scandal to launch, and a BBC project which I hope to tell you about in a few more weeks. But I will continue to write updates on post office scandal .uk, and I'm sure Rebecca will find the time to do some work on her Substack page when interesting things about the post office scandal arise.
Yes. Investigating the Post Office Scandal is produced and presented by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace, with sage advice and support from Whistledown Productions.
We will be back soon, I hope.
Bye.